podcast from AusCert's 2009 conference is brought to you by Microsoft. For full risky business coverage of AusCert, point your browser to risky.biz.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business 2. I'm Patrick Gray. As you heard in the introduction there, our coverage of AusCert's 2009 conference is made possible by Microsoft. And as a part of that sponsorship arrangement thingy, we're doing these sponsored podcasts. And in this one, we discuss the security features of Windows 7 with Microsoft's Jeff Alexander. I hope you enjoy it.
As you know, Windows Vista was quite a change in the way that we actually looked at security. Mm-hmm. There were deep changes in the operating system from a security point of view. But what Windows 7 does is it builds on that platform.
Okay.
But we've actually made some changes, particularly in a couple of different areas. First of that is actually being user account control, which you probably know is one of those ones that's commented on fairly regularly.
If by commented on you mean everyone was like, what are you guys doing?
Yes. Well, I mean, the thing is that we got a lot of feedback from customers that they wanted an operating system that was more secure and provided ways to actually lock it down.
Mm.
What we've done with UAC, though, is we've actually streamlined it to prompt less.
Yeah.
Okay, so the operating system doesn't prompt you as much.
Mm.
So, for example, by default, if you're an administrator on the machine, you're not going to get prompted to go to Device Manager, for example.
Mm.
Okay. However, with user account control, it is still running as a high integrity process now. In the Windows 7 beta, it wasn't running as a high integrity process, and you could just change UAC without getting prompted. Now, anytime you actually change UAC, actually get prompted in the release candidate.
I do remember seeing some commentary around that saying, oh, you know, look what they've done with this process. So that's been fixed since the first release candidate?
Since beta, yes. That's been based on feedback we received from customers.
Mm.
And there was a lot of feedback sent to the product team and various other teams. And we looked at the way that the new slider, the dialog box that works with user account control, we have a new slider bar that goes up and down.
Yeah.
Feedback we had was that if you actually changed, the piece of malware could actually go in and actually move that slider bar up and down.
Mm.
But now because UAC runs as a high integrity process, you have to always say, yes, I'm going to change that, make that change.
All righty.
Okay.
I've got to ask too, with UAC and Vista, were you guys collecting any telemetry on how it was actually being used?
Yeah, we were. We received a lot of telemetry data back from Vista and the feedback we received is that essentially people were getting prompted too much for things that they shouldn't have been prompted for.
Was that telemetry or feedback and focus groups?
Feedback,
like
telemetry,
that?
Focus groups, all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And we've even getting that feedback on the Windows 7 beta as well.
Mm-hmm.
So people are saying, look, you know, I'm an administrator on the box. I don't want to have to be prompted for administrative tasks. And so what we've done to solve that issue is that everything that's part of the operating system that's installed is signed by a certificate.
Yep.
Okay, so anything in the Windows directory that's installed as part of the operating system is signed by a certificate, so we don't prompt.
Mm.
But the other thing you can do is you can control all that through group policy.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can control that level. And I think the feedback we got is that not a lot of people are actually using group policy to actually monitor how UAC was actually being used. The whole focus, I think, when we first came out with UAC is that people didn't understand that it was designed to be allowing you to run better as a standard user.
Mm.
So that was the... We were still seeing people running as administrators and getting prompted.
Yeah, which seems a little bit redundant, doesn't it?
Yeah, and what we've done with that is that there's a group policy setting that allows you to configure how admin approval mode actually works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we were getting a lot of feedback is people were saying, I'm an administrator on the box and I'm still getting prompted. What was happening is that admin approval mode was prompting them to go into the secure desktop. And so we changed that in Windows 7 so that everything that's core to the OS signed by a certificate or a PKI a certification.
So it won't ask you, do you really want to run calc.exe?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'll see things like in many things in Control Panel will not ask you. And for example, the classic one was with Vista RTM, if you went to the program files directory and you created a folder, you got prompted four times.
Mm.
Vista SP1 prompted twice.
Yeah.
With Windows 7, once.
Yeah.
So we're reducing that stuff as the prompting goes on.
The problem with that stuff is a lot of it becomes reflex. I remember back in the DOS days, you know, you'd always be asked if you really wanted to delete something.
Yeah.
And the whole thing of hitting Y with your index finger on your right hand and enter with your pinky, you know, would take you about 200 milliseconds.
And oops, exactly. You know exactly.
What did
I
just delete?
Exactly. And you know, oh god,
I used to support DOS 5, so
yeah,
I know.
You know exactly what I mean. Hey, moving away from UAC because you know it's telling that you guys you know want to talk about UAC first because it's like UAC was what you got heaps of flack over. So it sounds like you guys have taken steps to address users' concerns over that. But I understand you've also built some more interesting stuff under the hood. Like there's more DEP. Is that correct? You've actually built DEP into Win 7.
Yes, we have. Yeah. Mm. So the DEP stuff is built in, so we can protect the hardware based on whatever hardware you've got, that kind of stuff. But the big focus is we've got a lot of feedback around secure access. Mm. I don't know if you've any of your listeners talked to you about access to VPNs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So we focused on that area. So we're seeing direct access as a new feature in Windows 7. So we're basically taking away the VPN type scenario. So
How does that work?
Essentially, it's an always-on connection. Okay, so if you look at VPN today, as a user, if you want to get access to the corporate data when you're traveling, you typically have to VPN into the corporate network. What that introduces to a user is complexity to them. So what direct access does is it's an always-on connection to the corporate network. So, for example, I'm staying here at Royal Pines. I'm not sure if you're here or on the Gold Coast. Plug into the broadband in the hotel room, and in about 5 or 10 minutes, I've got corporate network access without having to VPN in. And essentially, this is a part of our Better Together story, I guess you could say, with Windows Server 2008 R2 and Windows 7. It means that we've made some changes to the IP protocol. We're using IPv6, IPsec. Now, we know that a lot of organizations don't have IPv6 in their environment, so we'll use some of the transition technologies.
I mean, these are features that you really want to think through, though, don't you?
Absolutely.
Because anything that is provisioning access one system to the other.
Well, we use IPsec to secure the communication channel between the client and the direct access server. Mm. So we're securing that with two different IPsec channels. The other thing is that because we have to secure they have to authenticate with a user plus their machine certificate. We have to get a certificate on the device. All that kind of stuff is going on. It integrates into network access protection, which we talked about seems like a year ago now.
Yeah, it was a year ago, I think.
So it's integrated into NAP, so we can also control their health. So if they're unhealthy, we're not going to let them in. I guess when you look at the way direct access is positioned is that it's something you do have to think about how you deploy it. Mm. And you've got to make sure we're kind of moving that complexity into the data center. And of course, with any type of project, you've got to think about that as you go forward.
Okay, so what else have we got under the hood?
Under the hood, you probably heard of BitLocker.
Yeah, you got BitLocker Portable. This is a killer feature because there's so many data loss. I did an interview with a guy called Brian Martin who runs the Data Loss DB in the States, and we really looked at data loss by type. Incident, and there are so many incidents. It's so common that someone just leaves a USB key in a taxi or wherever, and then bang, they've got a real big problem on their hands.
Well, in our session yesterday, we showed a couple of things around BitLocker. First of all, BitLocker take up was slower than expected with Vista, mainly because of the complexities of how hard it was to set up. Mm. Because you had to actually partition the machine and all that kind of stuff beforehand.
Yeah.
You probably know all that stuff.
Yeah.
What we've done in Windows 7 is that by default, if the machine has got a TPM in it, which is where BitLocker keys are stored, it'll create a 100 meg hidden system partition for the boot files. Okay, so Windows 7 is a BitLocker ready operating system out of the box.
Yep.
Then it's just a simple case of going through the wizard and doing the setup for BitLocker on the host machine. With BitLocker to go, we've added it, like you said, to USB keys. In the audience, I always get people to raise their hands. How many of you have these devices, these USB keys? Mm. And people swap them and share them around. And I went up to Officeworks the other day and 4 gig I got for $19.95. So it's a huge amount of data that can go outside the organization. So what BitLocker to go allows us to do is it's a fully encapsulated BitLockered drive.
Yeah.
We can do a number of things with that. We can force through group policy that if you went over to my machine and you had a USB key and it wasn't BitLocker to code, that's a tough one.
It's an English language problem. It's not your fault.
So anyway, we go. You go around to my machine and you whack a USB key in. I can put a group policy on to say, well, that USB key is not encrypted.
Mm.
You can't write to it.
Mm.
So what we can set a group policy and how we handle those particular keys.
Well, that's nice, isn't it? Because it means you. It just minimizes the chance that you could accidentally wind up with, you know, 10 million customer records on someone's key ring.
Absolutely. So we think actually it's going to be very good because it also is down level, works with Windows Vista. Mm. So if you take that that USB key that's been encrypted with BitLocker, it can be used on Windows Vista. And we've added, because it's fully encapsulated in the USB key, we get read access on Windows XP.
Mm.
Okay, so if you bring it over to a Windows XP machine, you can read it, but you can't write to it.
I feel genuinely sorry for all the companies who make crypto point solutions for storage, you know, because really they've been trying to create a market for that and really get it out there and make it ubiquitous. And it just, I mean, you know, they've had limited success, but it hasn't really worked. And of course, now you guys have sort of baked it in as a standard feature of, an operating system that, you know, I would predict that it will be the next sort of XP style operating system that's everywhere. I mean, don't you feel just a little bit sorry for them?
Oh, look, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I can comment on that, but it's I guess, the way the world turns. I mean, we saw a need, and we got a lot of feedback from our customers as drives started getting, just commonplace around the place, and you can get 64 gig now on these devices.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, looking through the data, like you said, how much data is out there and how much is actually walking out of businesses. Mm. It was a natural transition for us that we did BitLocker on the host machine to kind of take that to removable drives. Mm. And this is USB keys as well as removable hard drives as well. Mm. So we can BitLocker those because we added multiple drive BitLocker with Vista SP1. So it was natural to move it to USB keys.
Yeah.
It doesn't just include USB keys. It's also those SD cards as well that you sit around. Because I've got an 8 gig in my machine. And
well, I imagine it'd be any sort of portable media, wouldn't it? Like if I plugged in my audio recorder, cameras, things like that?
No, it's storage. So it's looking at USB keys that have storage. With your camera, you're going to probably see a thing called device stage, which is new to Windows 7, that when you plug it in, Windows 7 will give you all the different things you can actually do with that device.
Okay, so it won't let me start. It won't let me start putting Word documents on a camera.
No. If you've got a camera, that kind of moves into our device stage type scenario. Yeah. We've got a new menu called Devices and Printers, and that has all the devices that you actually look after, like, you know, cameras, all that kind of stuff, mice, all that kind of thing go in there.
There's been a lot of problem with USB device control and stuff like that in the past, though. Are you anticipating at least some teething problems with this stuff?
Well, we've made some changes to autoplay. We're kind of doing a bit better job with handling how autoplay actually works. So that's getting a bit better. It's early days. We're getting good feedback so far at this point with BitLocker to go. I've been using BitLocker to go on a number of different devices, and it just seems to work. No problems. Okay. You put it in, and if you don't type the password, you can see the drive in Explorer, but you can't actually do anything until you type the password.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's an all or nothing thing because all the keys are on the actual USB. Yes.
Now you've got BitLocker Portable, and now you've got AppLocker as well. You've got everything Locker. What's AppLocker all about?
Well, AppLocker is how I tend to start this is that if you've worked in any kind of organization that comes out with an SOE, you're familiar with the term, with a standard operating environment, that standard operating environment tends to last about 2 seconds when you give it in the hands of the user because they go up, they download their favorite XYZ program. Essentially, what AppLocker allows us to do through group policy is it allows us to create a whitelist of applications that we are allowing inside our organization.
Mm.
Okay. The good thing...
And so if they somehow manage to wrangle an admin password temporarily and try to put some stuff group policy, unless they actually go in and change the group policy, whatever they install will get kicked or...
Get blocked. I mean, and essentially what we can do is we can do executable policies, Windows installer policies, and script policies. Mm. So we can say, look, only allow signed scripts or only allow signed installer packages. But the good thing about what makes AppLocker so powerful is that it's not like software restriction policies. But what we can do is that with AppLocker, we can kind of put exceptions to the rule. So I could have a rule in there to say Office 2007 system, and then I could go and set a deny rule to block individual applications, and then I can get into file hash as well.
Okay, so we can do.
Yeah. So what we do, like the example I do is I use Adobe Reader for that. You crack open the executable.
Use Adobe Reader? A reader?
Oh, every now and again. Yeah.
No, don't
But
do
I
that.
Use XPS. I generally use the XPS Reader, but I use it in my demos to just example of how we actually go and look at a third-party application that a user would probably download.
Mm.
I open up the executable file, and then I get a little slider bar to tell me, okay, well, what version of Adobe Reader do I want to restrict? Mm. And I can do custom values like 8 and above or whatever it may be. And it allows me to get very granular about how that. So we actually look at the header and the hash of the file to be able to actually block that application from running in our environment. So it's very cool.
Yep. All right. Well, Jeff Alexander, I think that covers it. Thank you very much for joining us here at OSSER.
No, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.